left a paper trail. Not good for passengers escorting a drugged and kidnapped little girl. Still, needs must when the devil drives.
Time you got back on the road, Rose said. You take care of my Barry, big man. The rest of them, too.
Is everyone okay at your end?
Sure, Rose said, and hung up before he could ask her anything else.
That was okay. Sometimes you didn't need telepathy to tell when someone was lying. Even the rubes knew that. He tossed the phone on the table and clapped his hands briskly. Okay, let's gas and go. Next stop, Sturbridge, Massachusetts. Nut, you stick with Barry. I'll drive the next 6 hours. Then you're up, Jimmy.
I want to go home, Jimmy Numbers said morosely. He was about to say more, but a hot hand grabbed his wrist before he could.
We got no choice about this, Barry said.
His eyes were glittering with fever, but they were sane and aware. In that moment, Crow was very proud of him.
No choice at all, computer boy. So man up. True comes first. Always.
Crow sat down behind the wheel and turned the key. Jimmy, he said, sit with me a minute. Want to have a little gab. Jimmy Numbers sat down in the passenger seat. These three girls, how old are they? Do you know?
That and a lot of other stuff. I hacked their school records when I got the pictures. In for a penny, in for a pound, right? Dean and Cross are 14. The Stone Girl is a year younger. She skipped a grade in elementary school.
I find that suggestive of steam, Crow said.
Yeah.
And they all live in the same neighborhood.
Right.
I find that suggestive of chumminess. Jimmy's eyes were still swollen with tears, but he laughed.
Yeah, girls, you know. All three of them probably wear the same lipstick and moan over the same bands. What's your point?
No point, Crow said. Just information. Information is power, or so they say. 2 minutes later, Steamhead Steve's Bago was merging back onto Interstate 90. When the speedometer was pegged at 65, Crow put on the cruise control and let it ride.
7. Dan outlined what he had in mind, then waited for Dave Stone to respond. For a long time, he only sat beside Abra with his head lowered and his hands clasped between his knees.
Daddy, Abra asked, please say something.
Dave looked up and said,
Who wants a beer?
Dan and John exchanged a brief bemused glance and declined.
Well, I do. What I really want is a double shot of Jack, but I'm willing to stipulate with no input from you gentlemen that sipping whiskey might not be such a good idea tonight.
I'll get it, Dad.
Abra bounced into the kitchen. They heard the snap of the flip-top and the hiss of the carbonation, sounds that brought back memories for Dan, many of them treacherously happy. She returned with a can of Coors and a Pilsner glass.
Can I pour it?
Knock yourself out.
Dan and John watched with silent fascination as Abra tilted the glass and slid the beer down the side to minimize the foam, operating with the casual expertise of a good bartender. She handed the glass to her father and set the can on a coaster beside him. Dave took a deep swallow, sighed, closed his eyes, then opened them again.
That's good, he said.
I bet it is, Dan thought, and saw Abra watching him. Her face, usually so open, was inscrutable, and for the moment he could not read the thoughts behind it.
Dave said, What you're proposing is crazy, but it has its attractions. Chief among them would be a chance to see these creatures with my own eyes. I think I need to because, in spite of everything you've told me, I find it impossible to believe in them, even with the glove and the body you say you found.
Abra opened her mouth to speak. Her father stayed her with a raised hand.
I believe that you believe, he went on. All three of you. and I believe that some group of dangerously deranged individuals might be after my daughter. I'd certainly go along with your idea, Mr. Torrance, if it didn't mean bringing Abra. I won't use my kid as bait.
You wouldn't have to, Dan said. He was remembering how Abra's presence in the loading dock area behind the ethanol plant had turned him into a kind of human cadaver dog, and the way his vision had sharpened when Abra opened her eyes inside his head. He had even cried her tears, although a DNA test might not have shown it.
What do you mean?
Your daughter doesn't have to be with us to be with us. She's unique that way. Abra, do you have a friend you could visit tomorrow after school? Maybe even stay with overnight?
Sure, Emma Dean.
He could see by the excited sparkle in her eyes that she already understood what he had in mind.
Bad idea, Dave said. I won't leave her unguarded.
Abra was being guarded all the time we were in Iowa, John said. Abra's eyebrows shot up and her mouth dropped open a little. Dan was glad to see this. He was sure she could have picked his brain any old time she wanted to, but she had done as he asked.
Dan took out his cell and speed dialed. Billy, why don't you come on in here and join the party?
3 minutes later, Billy Freeman stepped into the Stonehouse. He was wearing jeans, a red flannel shirt with tails hanging almost to his knees, and a teeny town railroad cap, which he doffed before shaking hands with Dave and Abra.
You helped him with his stomach, Abra said, turning to Dan. I remember that.
You've been picking my brains after all, Dan said. She flushed.
Not on purpose. Never. Sometimes it just happens.
Don't I know it?
All respect to you, Mr. Freeman, Dave said, but you're a little old for bodyguard duty, and this is my daughter we're talking about.
Billy raised his shirt tails and revealed an automatic pistol in a battered black holster.
1911 Colt, he said. Full auto. World War II vintage. This is old too, but it'll do the job.
Abra, John asked, do you think bullets can kill these things, or is it only childhood diseases? Abra was looking at the gun.
Oh, yes, she said. Bullets would work. They're not ghosty people. They're as real as we are.
John looked at Dan and said, I don't suppose you have a gun. Dan shook his head and looked at Billy.
I've got a deer rifle I could loan you, Billy said.
That might not be good enough, Dan said. Billy considered.
Okay. I know a guy down in Madison. He buys and sells bigger stuff. Some of it much bigger.
Oh, Jesus, Dave said. This just gets worse. But he didn't say anything else. Dan said, Billy, could we reserve the train tomorrow if we wanted to have a sunset picnic at Cloud Gap?
Sure. People do it all the time, especially after Labor Day, when the rates go down.
Abra smiled. It was one Dan had seen before. It was her angry smile. He wondered if the True Knot might have had second thoughts if they knew their target had a smile like that in her repertoire.
Good, she said. Good.
Abra? Dave looked bewildered and a little frightened.
What?
Abra ignored him for the moment. It was Dan she spoke to.
They deserve it for what they did to the baseball boy.
She wiped at her mouth with a cupped hand as if to erase that smile, but when she pulled the hand away, the smile was still there, her thinned lips showing the tips of her teeth. She clenched the hand into a fist.
They deserve it.
Part 3. Matters of Life and Death. Chapter 13. Cloud Gap. 1. Easy Mail Services was in a strip mall between a Starbucks and O'Reilly Auto Parts. Crow entered just after 10 a.m., presented his Henry Rothman ID, signed for a package the size of a shoebox, and walked back out with it under his arm. In spite of the air conditioning, the Winnebago was rank with the stench of Barry's sickness, but they had grown used to it and hardly smelled it at all. The box bore the return address of a plumbing supply company in Flushing, New York. There actually was such a company, but it had had no hand in this particular delivery. Crow, Snake, and Jimmy Numbers watched as Nut sliced the tape with his Swiss Army knife and lifted the flaps. He pulled out a wad of inflated plastic packing, then a double fold of cotton fluff. Beneath it, set in styrofoam, was a large, unlabeled bottle of straw-colored fluid, 8 syringes, 8 darts, and a skeletal pistol.
Holy shit! There's enough stuff there to send your whole class to Middle Earth, Jimmy said.
Rose has a great deal of respect for this little chiquita, Crow said. He took the tranquilizer gun out of its styrofoam cradle, examined it, put it back. We will, too.
Crow!
Barry's voice was clotted and hoarse.
Come here!
Crow left the contents of the box to Walnut and went to the man sweating on the bed. Barry was now covered with hundreds of bright red blemishes, his eyes swollen almost shut, his hair matted to his forehead. Crow could feel the fever baking off him, but the chink was a hell of a lot stronger than Grandpa Flick had been. He still wasn't cycling.
You guys okay?
Barry asked.
No fever? No spots?
We're fine. Never mind us. You need to rest. Maybe get some sleep.
I'll sleep when I'm dead. And I ain't dead yet.
Barry's red-streaked eyes gleamed.
I'm picking her up.
Crow grabbed his hand without thinking about it, reminded himself to wash it with hot water and plenty of soap, then wondered what good that would do. They were all breathing his air, had all taken turns helping him to the Jakes. Their hands had been all over him.
Do you know which one of the three girls she is? Have you got her name?
No.
Does she know we're coming for her?
No. Stop asking questions and let me tell you what I do know. She's thinking about Rose. That's how I homed in. But she's not thinking about her by name. The woman in the hat with the one long tooth. That's what she calls her. The kids...
Barry leaned to one side and coughed into a damp handkerchief.
The kid's afraid of her.
She ought to be, Crow said grimly. Anything else?
Ham sandwiches. Deviled eggs.
Crow waited.
I'm not sure yet, but I think she's planning a picnic. Maybe with her parents. They're going on a toy train?
Barry frowned. What toy train? Where?
Don't know. Get me closer and I will. I'm sure I will.
Barry's hand turned in Crow's and suddenly bore down almost hard enough to hurt.
She might be able to help me, Daddy. If I can hold on and you can get her. Hurt her enough to make her breathe out some steam. Then maybe...
Maybe, Crow said. But when he looked down, he could see, just for a second, the bones inside Barry's clutching fingers. 2. Abra was extraordinarily quiet at school that Friday. None of the faculty found this strange, although she was ordinarily vivacious and something of a chatterbox. Her father had called the school nurse that morning and asked if she would tell Abra's teachers to take it a bit easy on her. She wanted to go to school, but they had gotten some bad news about Abra's great-grandmother the day before. "She's still processing," Dave said. The nurse said she understood and would pass on the message. What Abra was actually doing that day was concentrating on being in two places at the same time. It was like simultaneously patting your head and rubbing your stomach. Hard at first, but not too difficult once you got the hang of it. Part of her had to stay with her physical body, answering the occasional question in class, a veteran hand-raiser since first grade. Today she found it annoying to be called on when she was just sitting with them neatly folded on her desk, talking with her friends at lunch, and asking Coach Rennie if she could be excused from gym and go to the library instead.
I've got a stomachache, she said, which was middle school fem code for I've got my period. She was equally quiet at Emma's house after school, but that wasn't a big problem. Emma came from a bookish family, and she was currently reading her way through Catching Fire for the third time. Mr. Dean tried to chat Abra up when he came home from work, but quit and dove into the latest issue of The Economist when Abra answered in monosyllables and Mrs. Dean gave him a warning look. Abra was vaguely aware of Emma putting her book aside and asking if she wanted to go out in the backyard for a while, but most of her was with Dan, seeing through his eyes, feeling his hands and feet on the controls of the Helen Rivington's little engine, tasting the ham sandwich he ate and the lemonade he chased it down with. When Dan spoke to her father, it was actually Abra speaking. As for Dr. John, he was riding at the very back of the train, and consequently there was no Dr. John. Just the two of them in the cab, a little father and daughter bonding in the wake of the bad news about Momo, cozy as could be. Occasionally her thoughts turned to the woman in the hat, the one who had hurt the baseball boy until he died and then licked up his blood with her deformed and craving mouth. Abra couldn't help it, but wasn't sure it mattered. If she were being touched by Barry's mind, her fear of Rose wouldn't surprise him, would it? She had an idea she couldn't have fooled the True Knots locator if he had been healthy, but Barry was extremely sick. He didn't know she knew Rose's name. It hadn't even occurred to him to wonder why a girl who wouldn't be eligible for a driver's license until 2015 was piloting the teeny town train through the woods west of Fraser. If it had, he probably would have assumed the train didn't really need a driver. Because he thinks it's a toy.
Scrabble?
Hmm? She looked around at Emma, at first not even sure where they were. Then she saw she was holding a basketball. Okay, the backyard. They were playing horse.
I asked if you wanted to play Scrabble with me and my mom, because this is totally boring.
You're winning, right?
Duh, all three games. Are you here at all?
Sorry, I'm just worried about my Momo. Scrabble sounds good. It sounded great, in fact. Emma and her mom were the slowest Scrabble players in the known universe and would have shit large bricks if anyone had suggested playing with a timer. This would give Abra plenty of opportunity to continue minimizing her presence here. Barry was sick, but he wasn't dead. And if he got wise to the fact that Abra was performing a kind of telepathic ventriloquism, the results could be very bad. He might figure out where she really was. Not much longer. Pretty soon they'll all come together. God, please let it go okay. While Emma cleared the crap off the table in the downstairs rec room and Mrs. Dean set up the board, Abra excused herself to use the toilet. She did need to go, but first she made a quick detour into the living room and peeked out the bow window. Billy's truck was parked across the street. He saw the curtains twitch and flashed her a thumbs up. Abra returned the gesture. Then the small part of her that was here went to the bathroom, while the rest of her sat in the cab of the Helen Rivington. We'll eat our picnic, pick up our trash, watch the sunset, and then we'll go back. Eat our picnic, pick up our trash, watch the sunset, and then... Something unpleasant and unexpected broke into her thoughts and hard enough to snap her head back. A man and two women. The man had an eagle on his back, and both women had tramp stamps. Abra could see the tattoos because they were having naked sex beside a pool while stupid old disco music played. The woman was letting out a lot of fake moans. What in hell had she stumbled across? The shock of what those people were doing destroyed her delicate balancing act, and for a moment Abra was all in one place, all here. Cautiously, she looked again and saw the people by the pool were all blurry, not real, almost ghosty people. And why? Because Barry was almost a ghosty person himself and had no interest in watching people have sex by the... Those people aren't by a pool. They're on TV.
Did Barry the Chink know she was watching him watch some porno TV show? Him and the others? Abra wasn't sure, but she didn't think so. They had taken the possibility into account, though. Oh, yes. If she was there, they were trying to shock her into going away, or into revealing herself, or both.
Abra, Emma called, we're ready to play.
We're playing already, and it's a much bigger game than Scrabble. She had to get her balance back, and quickly. Never mind the porno TV with the crappy disco music. She was in the little train. She was driving the little train. It was her special treat. She was having fun. We're going to eat. We're going to pick up our trash. We're going to watch the sunset. And then we're going to go back. I'm afraid of the woman in the hat, but not too afraid, because I'm not home. I'm going to Cloud Gap with my dad.
Abra! Did you fall in?
Coming, she called. Just want to wash my hands. I'm with my dad. I'm with my dad, and that's all. Looking at herself in the mirror, Abra whispered, Hold that thought.
3. Jimmy Numbers was behind the wheel when they pulled into the Bretton Woods rest stop, which was quite close to Anniston, the town where the troublesome girl lived. Only she wasn't there. According to Barry, she was in a town called Fraser, a little further southeast, on a picnic with her dad, making herself scarce. Much good it would do her. Snake inserted the first video in the DVD player. It was called Kinney's Poolside Adventure. If the kid's watching this, she's gonna get an education, she said, and pushed play. Nut was sitting beside Barry and feeding him more juice. When he could, that was. Barry had begun to cycle for real. He had little interest in juice, and none at all in the poolside menage a trois. He only looked at the screen because those were their orders. Each time he came back to his solid form, he groaned louder.
Crow, he said. Get with me, Daddy!
Crow was beside him in an instant, elbowing Walnut aside.
Lean close, Barry whispered,
and, after one uneasy moment, Crow did as he was asked. Barry opened his mouth, but the next cycle started before he could speak. His skin turned milky, then thin to transparency. Crow could see his teeth locked together, the sockets that held his pain-filled eyes, and, worst of all, the shadowy crenellations of his brain. He waited, holding a hand that was no longer a hand but only a nestle of bones. Somewhere, at a great distance, that twanky disco music went on and on. Crow thought, they must be on drugs. You couldn't fuck to music like that unless you were. Slowly, slowly, Barry the Chink grew dense again. This time, he screamed as he came back. Sweat stood out on his brow. So did the red spots, now so bright they looked like beads of blood. He wet his lips and said,
Listen to me.
Crow listened. 4. Dan did his best to empty his mind so Abra could fill it. He had driven the Riv out to Cloud Gap often enough for it to be almost automatic, and John was riding back by the caboose with the guns, two automatic pistols and Billy's deer rifle. Out of sight, out of mind, or almost. You couldn't completely lose yourself even while you were asleep, but Abra's presence was large enough to be a little scary. Dan thought if she stayed inside his head long enough and kept broadcasting at her current power, he would soon be shopping for snappy sandals and matching accessories. Not to mention mooning over the groovy boys who made up the band round here. It helped that she had insisted at the last minute that he take Hoppy, her old stuffed rabbit.
It will give me something to focus on, she had said.
All of them unaware that a not-quite-human gentleman whose rube name was Barry Smith would have understood perfectly. He had learned the trick from Grandpa Flick and used it many times. It also helped that Dave Stone kept up a constant stream of family stories, many of which Abra had never heard before. And still, Dan wasn't convinced any of this would have worked if the one in charge of finding her hadn't been sick. "Can't the others do this location thing?" he had asked her. "The lady in the hat could, even from halfway across the country, but she's staying out of it." That unsettling smile had once more curved Abra's lips and exposed the tips of her teeth. It made her look far older than her years. "Rose is scared of me." Abra's presence in Dan's head wasn't constant. Every now and then he would feel her leave as she went the other way, reaching out, oh so carefully, to the one who had been foolish enough to slip Bradley Trevor's baseball glove on his hand. She said they had stopped in a town called Starbridge, Dan was pretty sure she meant Sturbridge, and left the turnpike there, moving along the secondary roads toward the bright blip of her consciousness. Later on, they had stopped at a roadside cafe for lunch, not hurrying, making the final leg of the trip last. They knew where she was going now, and were perfectly willing to let her get there, because Cloud Gap was isolated. They thought she was making their job easier, and that was fine. But this was delicate work, a kind of telepathic laser surgery. There had been one unsettling moment when a pornographic image filled Dan's mind, some kind of group sex by a pool, but it had been gone almost at once. He supposed he had gotten a peek into her undermind where, if you believe Dr. Freud, all sorts of primal images lurked. This was an assumption he would come to regret, although never to blame himself for. He had taught himself not to snoop into people's most private things. Dan held the riv steering yoke with one hand. The other was on the mangy stuffed bunny in his lap. Deep woods, now starting to flame with serious color, flowed by on both sides. In the right-hand seat, the so-called conductor seat, Dave rambled on, telling his daughter family stories and dancing at least one family skeleton out of the closet. "When your mom called yesterday morning, she told me there's a trunk stored in the basement of Momo's building. It's marked Alessandra. You know who that is, don't you?"
"Grandma Sandy," Dan said.
Christ, even his voice sounded higher. Younger.
"Right you are. Now, here's something you might not know, and if that's the case, you didn't hear it from me, right?"
"No, Daddy."
Dan felt his lips curve up as some miles away, Abra smiled down at her current collection of Scrabble tiles. S-P-O. N-D-L-A.
"Your Grandma Sandy graduated from SUNY Albany, the State University of New York, and was doing her student teaching at a prep school, okay? Vermont, Massachusetts, or New Hampshire, I forget which. Halfway through her 8 weeks, she up and quit, but she hung around for a while, maybe picking up some part-time work, waitressing or something. For sure going to a lot of concerts and parties. She was
5. A good time girl. That made Abra think of the 3 sex maniacs by the pool smooching and gobbling to old-time disco music. Ugh. Some people had very strange ideas of what was a good time. "Abra," that was Mrs. Dean, "it's your turn, honey." If she had to keep this up for long, she'd have a nervous breakdown. It would have been so much easier to home by herself. She'd even floated the idea to her father, but he wouldn't hear of it, not even with Mr. Freeman watching over her. She used a U on the board to make P-O-U-N-D. "Thanks, Abba Doofus, I was going there," Emma said. She turned the board and began to study it with beady-eyed final exam concentration that would go on for another 5 minutes at least. Maybe even 10. Then she would make something totally lame like R-A-P or P-A-D. Abra returned to the riv. What her father was saying was sort of interesting, although she knew more about it than he thought she did. "Abby, are you?"
6. "Abby, are you listening?"
"Sure," Dan said.
I just had to take a little time out to play a word.
This is interesting.
Anyway, Momo was living in Manhattan at that time, and when Alessandra came to see her that June, she was pregnant.
Pregnant with Mom?
That's right, Abadul.
So Mom was born out of wedlock?
Total surprise and maybe the tiniest bit overdone. Dan, in the peculiar position of both participating and eavesdropping on the discussion, now realized something he found touching and sweetly comic.
Abra knew perfectly well that her mother was illegitimate. Lucy had told her the year before. What Abra was doing now, strange but true, was protecting her father's innocence.
That's right, honey. But it's no crime. Sometimes people get, I don't know, confused. Family trees can grow strange branches, and there's no reason for you not to know that.
Grandma Sandy died a couple of months after Mom was born, right? In a car wreck.
That's right. Momo was babysitting Lucy for the afternoon and ended up raising her. That's the reason they're so close and why Momo getting old and sick has been so hard on your mom.
Who was the man who got Grandma Sandy pregnant? Did she ever say?
Tell you what, Dave said. That's an interesting question. If Alessandra ever told, Momo kept it to herself. He pointed ahead at the lane cutting through the woods. Look, honey, almost there.
They were passing a sign reading, Cloud Gap Picnic Area, 2 miles.
7.
Crow's party made a brief stop in Anniston to gas up the Winnebago, but on Lower Main Street, at least a mile from Richland Court. As they left town, Snake now at the wheel, and an epic called Swinging Sorority Sisters on the DVD player, Barry called Jimmy Numbers to his bed.
You guys got to step it up a notch, Barry said. They're almost there. It's a place called Cloud Gap. Did I tell you that?
Yeah, you did. Jimmy almost patted Barry's hand and thought better of it.
They'll be spreading their picnic in no time. That's when you should take them, while they're sat down and eating.
We'll get it done, Jimmy promised, and in time to twist enough steam out of her to help you. Rose can't object to that.
She never would,
Barry agreed.
But it's too late for me. Maybe not for you, though.
Huh?
Look at your arms.
Jimmy did, and saw the first spots blooming on the soft white skin below his elbows.
Red death. His mouth went dry at the sight of them.
Oh, Christ, here I go,
Barry moaned, and suddenly his clothes were collapsing in on a body that was no longer there. Jimmy saw him swallow, and then his throat was gone.
Move, Nut said. Let me at him.
Yeah, what are you going to do? He's cooked. Jimmy went up front and dropped into the passenger seat which Crow had vacated. Take Route 14A around Fraser, he said. That's quicker than going through the downtown. You'll connect with the Saco River Road.
Snake tapped the GPS.
I got all that programmed. You think I'm blind or just stupid? Jimmy barely heard her. All he knew was that he could not die. He was too young to die, especially with all the incredible computer developments just over the horizon. And the thought of cycling, the crushing pain every time he came back. No, no, absolutely not. Impossible.
Late afternoon light slanted in through the Bago's big front windows. Beautiful autumn sunlight. Fall was Jimmy's favorite season, and he intended to still be alive and traveling with the True Knot when it came around again. And again. And again. Luckily, he was with the right bunch to get this done. Crow Daddy was brave, resourceful, and cunning. The True had been in tough spots before. He would bring them through this one.
Watch for the sign pointing to the Cloud Gap picnic area. Don't miss it. Barry says they're almost there.
Jimmy, you're giving me a headache, Snake said.
Go sit down. We'll be there in an hour, maybe less.
Go sit, Jimmy Numbers said.
Snakebite Andy grinned and did so. They were just turning onto the Saco River Road when Barry the Chink cycled out, leaving only his clothes. They were still warm from the fever that had baked him.
8.
Barry's dead. There was no horror in this thought when it reached Dan, nor even an ounce of compassion, only satisfaction. Abra Stone might look like an ordinary American girl, prettier than some and brighter than most, but when you got below the surface, and not that far below either, there was a young Viking woman with a fierce and bloodthirsty soul. Dan thought it was a shame that she'd never had brothers and sisters. She would have protected them with her life. Dan dropped the riven to its lowest gear as the train came out of the deep woods and ran along a fence to drop. Below them, the Saco shone bright gold in the declining sun. The woods, sloping steeply down to the water on both sides, were a bonfire of orange, red, yellow, and purple. Above them, the puffy clouds drifting by seemed almost close enough to touch. He pulled up to the sign reading Cloud Gap Station in a chuff of air brakes, then turned the diesel off. For a moment, he had no idea what to say, but Abra said it for him using his mouth.
Thanks for letting me drive, Daddy. Now let's have our plunder.
In the Dean rec room, Abra had just made this word.
Our picnic, I mean.
I can't believe you're hungry after all you ate on the train, Dave teased.
I am, though. Aren't you glad I'm not anorexic?
Yes, Dave said. Actually, I am.
Dan saw John Dalton from the corner of his eye crossing the picnic area clearing, head down, feet noiseless on the thick pine duff. He was carrying a pistol in one hand and Billy Freeman's rifle in the other. Trees bordered a parking lot for motor traffic. After a single look back, John disappeared into them. During summer, the little lot and all the picnic tables would have been full. On this weekday afternoon in late September, Cloud Gap was dead empty except for them. Dave looked at Dan. Dan nodded. Abra's father, an agnostic by inclination but a Catholic by association, made the sign of the cross in the air and then followed John into the woods.
It's so beautiful here, Daddy,
Dan said. His invisible passenger was now talking to Hoppy, because Hoppy was the only one left. Dan set the lumpy, balding, one-eyed rabbit on one of the picnic tables, then went back to the first passenger car for the wicker picnic basket.
That's okay, he said to the empty clearing. I can get it, Dad.
9. In the Dean's rec room, Abra pushed back her chair and stood up.
I have to go to the bathroom again. I feel sick to my stomach, and after that, I think I better go home.
Emma rolled her eyes, but Mrs. Dean was all sympathy.
Oh, honey, is it your UNO?
Yes, and it's pretty bad.
Do you have the things you need?
In my backpack. I'll be fine. Excuse me.
That's right, Emma said. Quit while you're winning.
Emma!
Her mother cried.
That's okay, Mrs. Dean. She beat me at horse.
Abra went up the stairs, one hand pressed to her stomach in a way she hoped didn't look too fakey. She glanced outside again, saw Mr. Freeman's truck but didn't bother with the thumbs up this time. Once in the bathroom, she locked the door and sat down on the closed toilet lid. It was such a relief to be done juggling so many different selves.
Barry was dead.
Emma and her mom were downstairs. Now it was just the Abra in this bathroom and the Abra at Cloud Gap. She closed her eyes.
Dan!
I'm here.
You don't have to pretend to be me anymore.
She felt his relief and smiled. Uncle Dan had tried hard, but he wasn't cut out to be a chick. A light tentative knock at the door.
Girlfriend?
Emma.
You all right? I'm sorry if I was mean.
I'm okay. But I'm going to go home and take a Motrin and lie down.
I thought you were going to stay the night.
I'll be fine.
Isn't your dad gone?
I'll lock the doors until he gets back.
Well, want me to walk with you?
That's okay.
She wanted to be alone so she could cheer when Dan and her father and Dr. John took those things out. They would, too. Now that Barry was dead, the others were blind. Nothing could go wrong.
10. There was no breeze to rattle the brittle leaves, and with the riv shut down, the picnic area at Cloud Gap was very quiet. There was only the muted conversation of the river below, the squall of a crow, and the sound of an approaching engine. Them. The ones the Hat Woman had sent. Rose. Dan flipped up one side of the wicker basket, reached in, and gripped the Glock 22 Billy had provided him with. From what source, Dan didn't know or care. What he cared about was that it could fire 15 rounds without reloading, and if 15 rounds weren't enough, he was in a world of hurt. A ghost memory of his father came, Jack Torrance, smiling his charming, crooked grin and saying, "If that don't work, I don't know what to tell you." Dan looked at Abra's old stuffed toy. "Ready, Hoppy? I hope so. I hope we both are."
11. Billy Freeman was slouched behind the wheel of his truck but sat up in a hurry when Abra came out of the Dean house. Her friend, Emma, stood in the doorway. The two girls said goodbye, slapping palms first in an overhead high five, then down low. Abra started for her own house across the street and four doors down. That wasn't in the plan, and when she glanced at him, he raised both hands in a "what gives" gesture. She smiled and shot him another quick thumbs up. She thought everything was okay, he got that loud and clear. But seeing her outside and on her own made Billy uneasy, even if the freaks were 20 miles south of here. She was a powerhouse, and maybe she knew what she was doing, but she was also only 13. As he watched her go up the walk to her house, pack on her back and rummaging in her pocket for her key, Billy leaned over and thumbed the button on his glove compartment. His own Glock 22 was inside. The pistols were rented firepower from a guy who was an emeritus member of the Road Saints New Hampshire chapter. In his younger years, Billy had sometimes ridden with them but had never joined. On the whole, he was glad, but he understood the pull. The camaraderie. He supposed it was the way Dan and John felt about the drinking. Abra slipped into her house and closed the door. Billy didn't take either the Glock or his cell phone out of the glove compartment. Not yet. But he didn't close the compartment either. He didn't know if it was what Dan called the shining, but he had a bad feeling about this. Abra should have stayed with her friend. She should have stuck to the plan.
12.
They ride in campers and Winnebagos, Abra had said, and it was a Winnebago that pulled into the parking lot where the Cloud Gap access road dead-ended. Dan sat watching with his hand in the picnic basket. Now that the time had come, he felt calm enough. He turned the basket so one end faced the newly arrived RV and flicked off the Glock safety with his thumb. The Bago's door opened, and Abra's would-be kidnapper spilled out one after the other. She had also said they had funny names, pirate names, but these looked like ordinary people to Dan. The men were the going-on elderly kind you always saw pooting around in campers and RVs. The woman was young and good-looking in an all-American way that made him think of cheerleaders who still had their figures 10 years after high school, and maybe after a kid or two. She could have been the daughter of one of the men. He felt a moment's doubt. This was, after all, a tourist spot, and it was the beginning of leaf-peeping season in New England. He hoped John and David would hold their fire. It would be horrible if they were just innocent by... Then he saw the rattlesnake bearing its fangs on the woman's left arm, and the syringe in her right hand. The man crowding in close beside her had another syringe, and the man in the lead had what looked very much like a pistol in his belt. They stopped just inside the birch poles marking the entrance to the picnic area.
The one in the lead disabused Dan of any lingering doubts he might have had by drawing the pistol. It didn't look like a regular gun. It was too thin to be a regular gun.
"Where's the girl?"
With the hand not in the picnic basket, Dan pointed to Hoppy the stuffed rabbit.
"That's as close to her as you're ever going to get."
The man with the funny gun was short, with a widow's peak above a mild-mannered accountant's face. A soft pod of well-fed stomach hung over his belt. He was wearing chinos and a t-shirt reading, "God does not deduct from man's allotted span the hours spent fishing."
"I have a question for you, Honey Bunch," the woman said. Dan raised his eyebrows.
"Go ahead."
"Aren't you tired? Don't you want to go to sleep?"
He did. All at once his eyelids were as heavy as sash weights. The hand holding the gun began to relax. 2 more seconds and he would have been crashed out and snoring with his head on the initial carved surface of the picnic table. But that was when Abra screamed,
"Where's the crow? I don't see the crow!"
13. Dan jerked as a man will when he is badly startled on the edge of sleep. The hand in the picnic basket spasmed, the Glock went off, and a cloud of wickerwork fragments flew. The bullet went wild, but the people from the Winnebago jumped, and the sleepiness left Dan's head like the illusion that it was. The woman with the snake tattoo and the man with the popcorny fringe of white hair flinched back, but the one with the odd-looking pistol charged forward, yelling,
"Get him! Get him! Get this, you kidnapping fuckers!"
Dave Stone shouted. He stepped out of the woods and began to spray bullets. Most of them went wild, but one hit Walnut in the neck, and the True's doctor went down on the pine duff, the hypo spilling from his fingers. 14. Leading the tribe had its responsibilities, but also its perks. Rose's gigantic Earth cruiser, imported from Australia at paralyzing expense and then converted to left-hand drive, was one. Having the lady's shower room at the Bluebell campground all to herself whenever she wanted it was another. After months on the road, there was nothing like a long hot shower in a big tiled room where you could hold your arms out or even dance around if the spirit moved you, and where the hot water didn't run out after 4 minutes. Rose liked to turn off the lights and shower in darkness. She found she did her best thinking that way, and for just that reason, she had headed to the shower immediately after the troubling cell phone call she'd gotten at 1 p.m. Mountain Time. She still believed everything was all right, but a few doubts had begun to sprout, like dandelions on a previously flawless lawn. If the girl was even smarter than they thought, or if she had enlisted help. No, it couldn't be. She was a steamhead for sure, the steamhead of all steamheads, but she was still only a child, a rube child. In any case, all Rose could do for the time being was wait on developments. After 15 refreshing minutes, she stepped out, dried off, wrapped herself in a fluffy bath sheet, and headed back to her RV carrying her clothes. Short Eddie and Big Mo were cleaning up the open-air barbecue area following another excellent lunch. Not their fault that nobody felt much like eating, with 2 more of the True showing those goddamned red spots. They waved to her. Rose was raising her own hand in return when a bundle of dynamite went off in her head. She went sprawling, her pants and shirt spilling from her hand, her bath sheet unraveled. Rose barely noticed. Something had happened to the raiding party. Something bad. She was digging for her cell in the pocket of her crumpled jeans as soon as her head began to clear. Never in her life had she wished so strongly and so bitterly that Crow Daddy was capable of long-distance telepathy, but with a few exceptions like herself, that gift seemed reserved for rube steamheads like the girl in New Hampshire. Eddie and Mo were running toward her. Behind them came Long Paul, Silent Sairy, Token Charlie, and Harpman Sam. Rose hit speed dial on her phone. 1,000 miles away, Crows gave just half a ring.
Hello, you've reached Henry Rothman. I can't talk to you right now, but if you leave your number and a brief message...
Fucking voicemail. Which meant his phone was either turned off or getting no service. Rose was betting the latter. Naked and on her knees in the dirt, her heels digging into the backs of her thighs, Rose smacked the center of her forehead with a hand not holding her cell. Crow, where are you? What are you doing? What's happening?
15. The man in the chinos and t-shirt fired his weird pistol at Dan. There was a chuff of compressed air and suddenly a dart was sticking out of Hoppy's back. Dan raised the Glock from the ruins of the picnic basket and fired again. Chino's guy took it in the chest and went over backwards grunting as fine droplets of blood blew out through the back of his shirt.
Andy Steiner was the last one standing. She turned, saw Dave Stone frozen there looking dazed, and charged at him with her hypodermic needle clutched in her fist like a dagger. Her ponytail swung like a pendulum. She was screaming. To Dan, everything seemed to have slowed down and gained clarity. He had time to see that the plastic protector sleeve was still on the end of the needle and had time to think, what kind of clowns are these guys? The answer, of course, was that they weren't clowns at all. They were hunters, completely unused to resistance from their prey. But of course children were their usual targets, and unsuspecting ones at that. Dave only stared at the howling harpy coming toward him. Perhaps his gun was empty. More likely that one burst had been his limit. Dan raised his own gun, but didn't shoot. The chances of missing the tattooed lady and hitting Abra's father were just too great. That was when John ran out of the woods and slammed into Dave's back, shoving him forward into the charging woman. Her screams, fury, dismay, were driven out of her in a gust of violently expelled air. They both tumbled over. The needle flew. As tattoo woman went scrabbling for it on her hands and knees, John brought the stock of Billy's deer rifle down on the side of her head. It was a full-force adrenaline-fueled blow. There was a crunch as her jaw broke. Her features twisted to the left, one eye bulging from its socket in a startled glare. She sprawled and rolled over on her back. Blood trickled from the corners of her mouth. Her hands clenched and opened. John dropped the rifle and turned to Dan, stricken.
I didn't mean to hit her that hard. Christ, I was just so scared.
Look at the one with the frizzy hair, Dan said. He got up on legs that felt too long and not all there. Look at him, John. John looked. Walnut lay in a pool of blood, one hand clutching his torn neck. He was cycling rapidly. His clothes fell in, then puffed out. The blood flowing through his fingers disappeared, then reappeared again. The fingers themselves were doing the same. The man had become an insane X-ray. John stepped back with his hands plastered over his mouth and nose. Dan still had that sense of slowness and perfect clarity. There was time to see Tattoo Woman's blood and a snarl of her blonde hair on the stock of the Remington pump also appearing and disappearing. It made him think of how her ponytail had pendulumed back and forth when she...
Dan, where's the crow? Where's the crow?
Ran at Abra's father. She had told them that Barry was cycling. Now Dan understood what she meant.
The one in the fishing shirt is doing it too, Dave Stone said. His voice was only slightly shaky, and Dan guessed he knew where some of his daughter's steel had come from. But he didn't have time to think about that now. Abra was telling him they hadn't gotten the whole crew. He sprinted to the Winnebago. The door was still open. He ran up the steps, threw himself on the carpeted floor, and managed to bang his head hard enough on the post under the eating table to send bright specks shooting across his field of vision. Never happens that way in the movies, he thought, and rolled over, expecting to be shot or stomped or injected by the one who had stayed behind to provide the rear guard. The one Abra called the Crow. They weren't totally stupid and complacent after all, it seemed. The Winnebago was empty. Appeared empty. Dan got to his feet and hurried through the kitchenette. He passed a fold-out bed rumpled from frequent occupancy. Part of his mind registered the fact that the RV smelled like the wrath of God in spite of the air conditioner that was still running. There was a closet, but the door stood open on its track and he saw nothing inside but clothes. He bent, looking for feet. No feet. He went on to the rear of the Winnebago and stood beside the bathroom door. He thought, more movie shit, and pulled it open, crouching as he did it. The Winnebago's can was empty, and he wasn't surprised. If anyone had tried hiding in there, he'd be dead by now. The smell alone would have killed him. Maybe someone did die in here, maybe this Crow. Abra came back at once, full of panic, broadcasting so powerfully that she scattered his own thoughts.
No, Barry's the one who died. Where's the Crow? Find the Crow!
Dan left the RV. Both of the men who had come after Abra were gone. Only their clothes were left. The woman, the one who had tried to send him to sleep, was still there, but wouldn't be for long. She had crawled to the picnic table with a ruined wicker basket on it, and now lay propped against one of the bench seats, staring at Dan, John, and Dave from her newly crooked face. Blood ran from her nose and mouth, giving her a red goatee. The front of her blouse was soaked. As Dan approached, her skin melted from her face, and her clothes fell inward against the strutwork of her skeleton. No longer held in place by her shoulders, the straps of her bra flopped in loops. Of her soft parts, only her eyes remained, watching Dan. Then her skin re-knit itself, and her clothes plumped up around her body. The fallen bra straps bit into her upper arms, the strap on the left gagging the rattlesnake so it couldn't bite. The finger bones clutching her shattered jaw grew a hand.
You fucked us,
Snakebite Andy said. Her voice was slurred.
Fucked by a bunch of rubes. I don't believe it.
Dan pointed at Dave. That rube there is the father of the girl you came to kidnap, just in case you're wondering. Snake managed a painful grin. Her teeth were rimmed with blood.
You think I give a tin shit? To me, he's just another swinging dick. Even the Pope of Rome's got one, and not one of you care where you put it. Fucking men have to win, don't you? Always have to win.
Where's the other one? Where's Crow? Andy coughed. Blood bubbled from the corners of her mouth. Once she had been lost, then she had been found. In a darkened movie theater, she had been found by a goddess with a thundercloud of dark hair. Now she was dying, and she wouldn't have changed a thing. The years between the ex-actor president and the black president had been good. That one magic night with Rose had been even better. She grinned brightly up at the tall, good-looking one. It hurt to grin, but she did it anyway.
Oh, him. He's in Reno. Fucking rube showgirls.
She began to disappear again. Dan heard John Dalton whisper, Oh my God, look at that. Brain bleed. I can actually see it. Dan waited to see if Tat Woman would come back. Eventually she did, with a long groan from between her clenched and bloody teeth. The cycling seemed to hurt even more than the blow that had caused it, but Dan thought he could remedy that. He pulled Tat Woman's hand away from her shattered jaw and dug in with his fingers. He could feel her entire skull shift as he did. It was like pushing the side of a badly cracked vase held together by a few strips of tape. This time, Tat Woman did more than groan. She howled and pawed weakly at Dan, who paid no attention. "Where's Crow?"
"Aniston!" Snake screamed. "He got off in Aniston! Please don't hurt me anymore, Daddy! Please don't! I'll do whatever you want!"
Dan thought of what Abra said these monsters had done to Brad Trevor in Iowa, how they had tortured him, and God only knew how many others, and felt an almost ungovernable urge to tear the lower half of this murdering bitch's face entirely off, to beat her bleeding, shattered skull with her own jawbone until both skull and bone disappeared. Then, absurdly given the circumstances, he thought of the kid in the Braves t-shirt reaching for the leftover Coke piled on the shiny magazine cover. "Kenny," he'd said. This woman was nothing like that kid. Nothing. But telling himself so did no good. His anger was suddenly gone, leaving him feeling sick and weak and empty.
"Don't hurt me anymore, Daddy."
He got up, wiping his hand on his shirt, and walked blindly toward the riv. "Abra, are you there?"
"Yes."
Not so panicky now, and that was good. "You need to have your friend's mom call the police and tell them you're in danger. Crow's in Aniston." Bringing the police into a business that was at bottom supernatural was the last thing Dan wanted, but at this moment he saw no choice.
"I'm not..."
Before she could finish, her thought was blotted out by a powerful shriek of female rage. "You little bitch!" Suddenly the Hat Woman was in Dan's head again, this time not as part of a dream, but behind his waking eyes, her image burning. A creature of terrible beauty who was now naked, her wet hair lying on her shoulders in Medusa coils. Then her mouth yawned open, and the beauty was torn away. There was only a dark hole with one jutting, discolored tooth, almost a tusk. "What have you done?" Dan staggered and put a hand against the Riv's lead passenger car to hold himself up. The world inside his head was revolving. The Hat Woman disappeared, and suddenly a crowd of concerned faces was gathered around him. They were asking if he was all right. He remembered Abra trying to explain how the world had revolved on the day she had discovered Brad Trevor's picture in the Aniston shopper, how all at once Abra had been looking out of the Hat Woman's eyes, and the Hat Woman had been looking out of hers. Now he understood. It was happening again. And this time he was along for the ride. Rose was on the ground. He could see a broad swatch of evening sky overhead. The people crowding around her were no doubt her tribe of child killers. This was what Abra was seeing. The question was, what was Rose seeing? 16. Snake cycled, then came back. It burned. She looked at the man kneeling in front of her. "Is there anything I can do for you?" John asked. "I'm a doctor." In spite of the pain, Snake laughed. This doctor, who belonged to the men who had just shot the Trues doctor to death, was now offering to help. What would Hippocrates make of that one? "Put a bullet in me, ass face. That's the only thing I can think of." The nerdy one, the bastard who'd actually pulled the trigger on Walnut, joined the one who said he was a doctor. "You deserve it," Dave said. "Did you think I was just going to let you take my daughter? Torture and kill her like you did that poor little boy in Iowa?" They knew about that. How could they? But it didn't matter now, at least not to Andy. "Your people slaughter pigs and cows and sheep,"
Is what we do any different?
In my humble opinion, killing human beings is a lot different, John said. Call me silly and sentimental.
Snake's mouth was full of blood and some lumpy shit. Teeth, probably. That didn't matter either. In the end, this might be more merciful than what Barry had gone through. It would certainly be quicker. But one thing needed straightening out, just so they'd know. We're the human beings. Your kind. Just Rubes. Dave smiled, but his eyes were hard. And yet, you're the one lying on the ground with dirt in your hair and blood all down the front of your shirt. I hope hell's hot enough for you. Snake could feel the next cycle coming on. With luck, it would be the last one, but for now she held tight to her physical form. You don't understand how it was with me before, or how it is with us. We're only a few, and we're sick. We've got...
I know what you've got, Dave said. Fucking measles. I hope they rot your whole miserable knot from the inside out.
Snake said, we didn't choose to be what we are any more than you did. In our shoes, you'd do the same.
John shook his head slowly from side to side. Never. Never.
Snake began to cycle out. She managed four more words, however. Fucking men. A final gasp as she stared up at them from her disappearing face. Fucking Rubes. Then she was gone.
17. Dan walked to John and Dave slowly and carefully, putting his hand on several of the picnic tables to keep his balance. He had picked up Abra's stuffed rabbit without even realizing it. His head was clearing, but that was a decidedly mixed blessing. We have to go back to Aniston and fast. I can't touch Billy. I could before, but now he's gone.
Abra? Dave asked. What about Abra?
Dan didn't want to look at him. Dave's face was naked with fear, but he made himself do it.
She's gone too. So's the woman in the hat. They've both dropped out of the mix.
Meaning what? Dave grabbed Dan's shirt in both hands.
Meaning what?
I don't know. This was the truth. But he was afraid.
Chapter 14. Crow. 1.
Get with me, Daddy, Barry the Chink had said. Lean close.
This was just after Snake had started the first of the porn DVDs. Crow got with Barry, even held his hand while the dying man struggled through his next cycle, and when he came back...
Listen to me. She's been watching, all right. Only when that porno started up.
Explaining to someone who couldn't do the locator thing was hard, especially when the one doing the talking was mortally ill, but Crow got the gist of it. The fucksome frolickers by the pool had shocked the girl, just as Rose had hoped they might, but they had done more than make her quit spying and pull back. For a moment or two, Barry's sense of her location seemed to double. She was still on the midget train with her dad riding to the place where they were going to have their picnic, but her shock had produced a ghost image that made no sense. In this, she was in a bathroom taking a leak.
Maybe you were seeing a memory, Crow said. Could that be?
Yeah,
Barry said.
Rubes think all kinds of crazy shit. Most likely it's nothing. But for a minute, it was like she was twins, you know?
Crow didn't exactly, but he nodded.
Only if that's not it, she might be running some kind of game. Give me the map.
Jimmy Numbers had all of New Hampshire on his laptop. Crow held it up in front of Barry.
Here's where she is,
Barry said, tapping the screen.
on her way to this Cloud Glen place with her dad.
Gap, Crow said. Cloud Gap.
Whatever the fuck.
Barry moved his finger northeast.
And this is where the ghost blip came from.
Crow took the laptop and looked through the bead of no doubt infected sweat Barry had left on the screen. Aniston? That's her hometown, Bear. She's probably left psychic traces of herself all over it. Like dead skin.
Sure. Memories, daydreams, all kinds of crazy shit. What I said.
And it's gone now.
Yeah, but...
Barry grasped Crow's wrist.
If she's as strong as Rose says, it's just possible that she really is gaming us. Throwing her voice like...
Have you ever run across a Steam ad that could do that?
No, but there's a first time for everything. I'm almost positive she's with her father, but you're the one who has to decide if almost positive is good enough for...
That was when Barry began cycling again, and all meaningful communication ceased. Crow was left with a difficult decision. It was his mission, and he was confident he could handle it, but it was Rose's plan, and more important, Rose's obsession. If he screwed up, there would be hell to pay. Crow glanced at his watch. 3 p.m. here in New Hampshire, 1 o'clock in Sidewinder. At the Bluebell campground, lunch would just be finishing up, and Rose would be available. That decided him. He made the call. He almost expected her to laugh and call him an old woman, but she didn't.
You know we can't entirely trust Barry anymore, she said. But I trust you. What's your gut feeling?
His gut felt nothing one way or the other. That was why he had made the call. He told her so and waited.
I leave it with you, she said. Just don't screw up.
Thanks for nothing, Rosie, darling. He thought this, then hoped she hadn't caught it. He sat with the closed cell phone still in his hand, swaying from side to side with the motion of the RV, inhaling the smell of Barry's sickness, wondering how long it would be before the first spots started showing up on his own arms and legs and chest. At last he went forward and put his hand on Jimmy's shoulder. When you get to Aniston, stop.
Why?
Because I'm getting off. 2. Crow Daddy watched them pull away from the gas and go on Aniston's lower Main Street, resisting an urge to send a short-range thought, all the ESP of which he was capable, to Snake before they got out of range. Come back and pick me up. This is a mistake. Only what if it wasn't? When they were gone, he looked briefly and longingly at the sad little line of used cars for sale at the car wash adjacent to the gas station. No matter what transpired in Aniston, he was going to need transpo out of town. He had more than enough cash in his wallet to buy something that would carry him to their agreed-on rendezvous point near Albany on I-87. The problem was time. It would take at least half an hour to transact a car deal. And that might be too long. Until he was sure this was a false alarm, he would just have to improvise and rely on his powers of persuasion. They had never let him down yet. Crow did take time enough to step into the Gas and Go where he bought a Red Sox hat. When in Bosox country, dressed as the Bosox fans do. He debated adding a pair of sunglasses and decided against them. Thanks to TV, a fit middle-aged man in sunglasses always looked like a hitman to a certain part of the population. The hat would have to do. He walked up Main Street to the library where Abra and Dan had once held a council of war. He had to go no farther than the lobby to find what he was looking for. There, under the heading of Take a Look at Our Town, was a map of Aniston with every street and lane carefully marked. He refreshed himself on the location of the girl's street.
Great game last night, wasn't it? A man asked. He was carrying an armload of books.
For a moment, Crow had no idea what he was talking about, then remembered his new hat.
It sure was, he agreed, still looking at the map.
He gave the Sox fan time to depart before leaving the lobby. The hat was fine, but he had no desire to discuss baseball. He thought it was a stupid game. 3. Richland Court was a short street of pleasant New England salt boxes and Cape Cods ending in a circular turnaround. Crow had grabbed a free newspaper called The Anniston Shopper on his walk from the library and now stood at the corner, leaning against a handy oak tree and pretending to study it. The oak shielded him from the street, and maybe that was a good thing, because there was a red truck with a guy sitting behind the wheel parked about halfway down. The truck was an oldie, with some hand tools and what looked like a rototiller in the bed, so the guy could be a groundskeeper. This was the kind of street where people could afford them. But if so, why was he just sitting there? Baby sitting, maybe? Crow was suddenly glad he had taken Barry seriously enough to jump ship. The question was, what to do now? He could call Rose, but their last conversation hadn't netted anything he couldn't have gotten from a magic eight ball. He was still standing half-hidden behind the fine old oak and debating his next move when the providence that favored the true knot above Rubes stepped in. A door partway down the street opened, and two girls came out. Crow's eyes were every bit as sharp as those of his namesake Bird, and he ID'd them at once as two of the three girls in Billy's computer pics. The one in the brown skirt was Emma Dean. The one in the black pants was Abra Stone. He glanced back at the truck. The driver, also an oldie, had been slouched behind the wheel. Now he was sitting up, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, on the alert. So she had been gaming them. Crow still didn't know for sure which of the two was the steamhead, but one thing he was sure of. The men in the Winnebago were on a wild goose chase. Crow took out his cell, but only held it in his hand for a moment, watching the girl in the black pants go down the walk to the street. The girl in the skirt watched her for a second, then went back inside. The girl in the pants, Abra, crossed Richland Court, and as she did, the man in the truck raised his hands in a "what gives" gesture. She responded with a thumbs up, "Don't worry, everything's okay." Crow felt a surge of triumph as hot as a knock of whiskey. Question answered. Abra Stone was the steamhead. No question about it. She was being guarded, and the guard was an old geezer with a perfectly good pickup truck. Crow felt confident it would take him and a certain young passenger as far as Albany. He hit Snake on the speed dial and wasn't surprised or uneasy when he got a "call failed" message. Cloud Gap was a local beauty spot, and God forbid there should be any cell phone towers to clutter up the tourists' snapshots. But that was okay. If he couldn't take care of an old man and a young girl, it was time to turn in his badge. He considered his phone for a moment, then turned it off. For the next 20 minutes or so, there was no one he wanted to talk to, and that included Rose. His mission, his responsibility. He had 4 loaded syringes, 2 in the left pocket of his light jacket, 2 in the right. Putting his best Henry Rothman smile on his face, the one he wore when reserving campground space or 4-walling motels for the true, Crow stepped from behind the tree and strolled down the street. In his left hand, he still held his folded copy of The Anniston Shopper. His right hand was in his jacket pocket, easing the plastic cap off one of the needles. 4.
Pardon me, sir. I seem to be a little lost. I wonder if you could give me some directions.
Billy Freeman was nervous, on edge, filled with something that was not quite foreboding, and still that cheerful voice and bright, "you can trust me" smile took him in. Only for 2 seconds, but that was enough. As he reached toward the open glove compartment, he felt a small sting on the side of his neck. "Bug bit me," he thought, and then slumped sideways, his eyes rolling up to the whites.
Crow opened the door and shoved the driver across the seat. The old guy's head bonked the passenger side window. Crow lifted limp legs over the transmission hump, batting the glove compartment closed to make a little more room, then slid behind the wheel and slammed the door. He took a deep breath and looked around, ready for anything. But there was nothing to be ready for. Richland Court was dozing the afternoon away, and that was lovely. The key was in the ignition. Crow started the engine, and the radio came on, and a yahoo roar of Toby Keith, "God Bless America and Pour the Beer." As he reached to turn it off, a terrible white light momentarily washed out his vision. Crow had very little telepathic ability, but he was firmly linked to his tribe. In a way, the members were appendages of a single organism, and one of their number had just died. Cloud Gap hadn't been just misdirection. It had been a fucking ambush. Before he could decide what to do next, the white light came again, and after a pause, yet again. All of them? Good Christ. All three. It wasn't possible. Was it? He took a deep breath, then another. Forced himself to face the fact that yes, it could be. And if so, he knew who was to blame. Fucking Steamhead Girl. He looked at Abra's house. All quiet there. Thank God for small favors. He had expected to drive the truck up the street and into her driveway, but all at once that seemed like a bad idea, at least for now. He got out, leaned back in, and grabbed the unconscious geezer by his shirt and belt. Crow yanked him back behind the wheel, pausing just long enough to give him a pat-down. No gun. Too bad. He wouldn't have minded having one, at least for a while. He fastened the geezer's seatbelt so he couldn't tilt forward and blare the horn. Then he walked down the street to the girl's house, not hurrying. If he'd seen her face at one of the windows, or so much as a single twitch of a single curtain, he would have broken into a sprint. But nothing moved. It was possible he could still make this work, but that consideration had been rendered strictly secondary by those terrible white flashes. What he mostly wanted was to get his hands on the miserable bitch that had caused him so much trouble and shake her until she rattled. 5. Abra sleepwalked down the front hall. The Stones had a family room in the basement, but the kitchen was their comfort place, and she headed there without thinking about it. She stood with her hands splayed out on the table, where she and her parents had eaten thousands of meals, staring at the window over the kitchen sink with wide, blank eyes. She wasn't really here at all. She was in Cloud Gap, watching bad guys spill out of the Winnebago. The Snake, and the Nut, and Jimmy Numbers. She knew their names from Barry. But something was wrong. One of them was missing. Where's the crow? Dan, I don't see the crow! No answer. Because Dan and her father and Dr. John were busy, they took the bad guys down one after the other. The Walnut first. That was her father's work, and good for him. Then Jimmy Numbers. Then the Snake. She felt each mortal injury as a thudding deep in her head. Those thuds, like a heavy mallet, repeatedly coming down on an oak plank, were terrible in their finality, but not entirely unpleasant, because they deserve it. They kill kids, and nothing else would have stopped them. Only, Dan, where's the crow? Where's the crow? Now Dan heard her. Thank God. She saw the Winnebago. Dan thought the crow was in there, and maybe he was right. Still, she hurried back down the hall and peered out one of the windows beside the front door. The sidewalk was deserted, but Mr. Freeman's truck was parked right where it belonged. She couldn't see his face because of the way the sun was shining on the windshield, but she could see him behind the wheel,
and that meant everything was still okay. Probably okay.
Abra, are you there?
Dan. It was so great to hear him. She wished he was with her, but having him inside her head was almost as good.
Yes.
She took one more reassuring look at the empty sidewalk and Mr. Freeman's truck, checked to make sure she had locked the door after coming in, and started back down to the kitchen.
You need to have your friend's mom call the police and tell them you're in danger. Crows in Anniston.
She stopped halfway down the hall. Her comfort hand came up and began to rub her mouth. Dan didn't know she had left the Dean's house. How could he? He'd been very busy.
I'm not.
Before she could finish, Rose the Hat's mental voice blasted through her head, wiping away all thought.
You little bitch! What have you done?
The familiar hallway between the front door and the kitchen began to sideslip. The last time this revolving thing happened, she'd been prepared. This time she wasn't. Abra tried to stop it and couldn't. Her house was gone. Anniston was gone. She was lying on the ground and looking up at the sky. Abra realized the loss of those three in Cloud Gap had literally knocked Rose off her feet, and she had a moment to be savagely glad. She struggled for something to defend herself with. There wasn't much time.
6.
Rose's body lay sprawled halfway between the showers and the Overlook Lodge, but her mind was in New Hampshire, swarming through the girl's head. There was no daydream horsewoman with a stallion and lance this time, oh no. This time, it was just one surprised little chickadee, an old Rosie, and Rosie wanted revenge. She would kill the girl only as a last resort. She was much too valuable for that. But Rose could give her a taste of what was coming. A taste of what Rose's friends had already suffered. There were plenty of soft, vulnerable places in the minds of rubes, and she knew them all very well.
Get away, you bitch! Leave me alone, or I'll fucking kill you!
It was like having a flashbang go off behind her eyes. Rose jerked and cried out. Big Mo, who had been reaching down to touch her, recoiled in surprise. Rose didn't notice, didn't even see her. She kept underestimating the girl's power. She tried to keep her footing in the girl's head, but the little bitch was actually pushing her out. It was incredible and infuriating and terrifying, but it was true. Worse, she could feel her physical hands rising toward her face. If Mo and Short Eddie hadn't restrained her, the little girl might have made Rose claw her own eyes out. For the time being, at least, she had to give up and leave. But before she did, she saw something through the girl's eyes that flooded her with relief. It was Crow Daddy, and in one hand he was holding a needle.
7. Abra used all the psychic force she could muster, more than she had used on the day she had gone hunting for Brad Trevor, more than she had ever used in her life, and it was still barely enough. Just when she started to think she wouldn't be able to get the Hat Woman out of her head, the world began to revolve again. She was making it revolve, but it was so hard, like pushing a great stone wheel.
The sky and the faces staring down at her slid away. There was a moment of darkness when she was between nowhere. And then her own front hall slid back into view. But she was no longer alone. A man was standing in the kitchen doorway. No, not a man. A crow.
Hello, Abra, he said, smiling, and leaped at her.
Still mentally reeling from her encounter with Rose, Abra made no attempt to push him away with her mind. She simply turned and ran.
8. In their moments of highest stress, Dan Torrance and Crow Daddy were very much alike, although neither would ever know it. The same clarity came over Crow's vision, the same sense that all of this was happening in beautiful slow motion. he saw the pink rubber bracelet on Abra's left wrist and had time to think breast cancer awareness. He saw the girl's backpack slew to the left as she whirled to her right and knew it was full of books. He even had time to admire her hair as it flew out behind her in a bright sheaf. He caught her at the door as she was trying to turn the thumb lock. When he put his left arm around her throat and yanked her back, he felt her first efforts, confused, weak, to push him away with her mind. Not the whole hypo, it might kill her. She can't weigh more than 115 pounds max. Crow injected her just south of the collarbone as she twisted and struggled. He needn't have worried about losing control and shooting the whole dose into her, because her left arm came up and thumped against his right hand, knocking the hypo free. It fell to the floor and rolled. But Providence favors true above rubes. It had always been that way and was now. He got just enough into her. He felt her little handhold on his mind first slip, then fall away. Her hands did the same. She stared at him with shocked, floating eyes. Crow patted her shoulder. "We're going for a ride, Abra. You're going to meet exciting new people." Incredibly, she managed a smile. A rather frightening one for a girl so young that, with her hair piled up under a cap, she could still have passed for a boy.
"Those monsters you call your friends are all dead. They..."
The last word was only an unwinding slur as her eyes rolled up and her knees came unhinged. Crow was tempted to let her drop. It would serve her too right. But restrained the impulse and caught her under the arms instead. She was valuable property, after all. True property. 9. He had come in through the rear door, snapping back the next to useless spring lock with a single downward flick of Henry Rothman's American Express Platinum card, but he had no intention of leaving that way. There was nothing but a high fence at the foot of the sloping backyard, and beyond that a river. Also, his transportation was in the other direction. He carried Abra through the kitchen and into the empty garage. Both parents at work, maybe. Unless they were out at Cloud Gap, gloating over Andy, Billy, and Nut. For now, he didn't give much of a shit about that end of things. Whoever had been helping the girl could wait. Their time would come. He slid her limp body under a table holding her father's few tools. Then he thumbed the button that opened the garage door and stepped out, being sure to slap on that big old Henry Rothman smile before he did. The key to survival in the world of rubes was to look as if you belonged, as if you were always on the good foot, and no one was better at it than Crow. He walked briskly down to the truck and moved the geezer again, this time to the middle of the bench seat. As Crow turned into the stone driveway, Billy's head lolled against his shoulder. "Getting a little chummy there, aren't you, old-timer?" Crow asked and laughed as he drove the red truck into the garage. His friends were dead, and this situation was horribly dangerous, but there was one big compensation. He felt totally alive and aware for the first time in a great many years. The world bursting with color and humming like a power line. He had her, by God! In spite of all her weird strength and nasty tricks, he had her. Now he would bring her to Rose. A love offering. "Jackpot!" he said, and gave the dashboard one hard, exultant hit. He stripped off Abra's backpack, left it under the work table, and lifted her into the truck on the passenger side. He seat-belted both of his snoozing passengers. It had certainly occurred to him to snap the geezer's neck and leave his body in the garage, but the geezer might come in handy. If the drug didn't kill him, that was. Crow checked for a pulse on the side of the grizzled old neck and felt it, slow but strong. There was no question about the girl. She was leaning against the passenger window, and he could see her breath fogging the glass. Excellent. Crow took a second to inventory his stock. No gun.
The true knot never traveled with firearms. But he still had 2 full hypos of the naughty time, night-night stuff. He didn't know how far 2 would get him, but the girl was his priority. Crow had an idea that the geezer's period of usefulness might prove to be extremely limited. Oh well, rubes came and rubes went. He took out his cell, and this time it was Rose he hit on the speed dial. She answered just as he had resigned himself to leaving a message. Her voice was slow, her pronunciation slurry. It was a little like talking to a drunk. "Rose, what's up with you?"
"The girl messed with me a trifle more than I expected, but I'm all right. I don't hear her anymore. Tell me you have her."
"I do, and she's having a nice nap. But she's got friends. I don't want to meet them. I'll head west immediately, and I've got no time to be fucking with maps. I need secondary roads that'll take me across Vermont and into New York."
"I'll put Toady Slim on it."
"You need to send someone east to meet me immediately, Rosie, and with whatever you can lay your hands on, it'll keep little Miss Nitro pacified, because I don't have much left. Look in nut supplies. He must have something."
"Don't tell me my business," she snapped.
"Toady will coordinate everything. You know enough to get started?" "Yes. Rosie, darling, that picnic area was a trap. The little girl fucking deked us. What if her friends call the cops? I'm riding in an old F-150 with a couple of zombies next to me in the cab. I might as well have kidnapper tattooed on my forehead." But he was grinning. Damned if he wasn't grinning. There was a pause at the other end. Crow sat behind the wheel in the Stones' garage waiting. At last Rose said,
"If you see blue lights behind you or a roadblock ahead of you, strangle the girl and suck out as much of her steam as you can while she goes. Then surrender. We'll take care of you eventually, you know that."
It was Crow's turn to pause. At last he said, "Are you sure that's the right way to go, darling?"
"I am." Her voice was stony. "She's responsible for the deaths of Jimmy, Nut, and Snakebite. I mourn them all, but it's Andy I feel the worst about, because I turned her myself, and she only had a taste of the life. Then there's Sayri."
She trailed off with a sigh. Crow said nothing. There was really nothing to say. Andy Steiner had been with a lot of women during her early years with the True. Not a surprise, steam always made newbies, especially Randy. But she and Sarah Carter had been a couple for the last 10 years and devoted to each other. In some ways, Andy had seemed more like Silent Sayri's daughter than her lover.
"Sayri's inconsolable," Rose said, "and black-eyed Susie's not much better about Nut. That little girl is going to answer for taking those 3 from us. One way or the other, her rube life is over. Any more questions?"
Crow had none. 10. No one paid any particular attention to Crow Daddy and his snoozing passengers as they left Anniston on the old Granite State Highway headed west. With a few notable exceptions, sharp-eyed old ladies and little kids were the worst. Rube America was staggeringly unobservant, even 12 years into the dark age of terrorism. "If you see something, say something" was a hell of a slogan, but first you had to see something. By the time they crossed into Vermont, it was growing dark, and the cars passing by in the other direction saw only Crow's headlights, which he purposely left on high beam. Toady Slim had called 3 times already, feeding him route information. Most were byroads, many unmarked. Toady had also told Crow that Diesel Doug, Dirty Phil, and Apron Annie were on their way. They were riding in an 06 Caprice that looked like a dog but had 400 horses under the hood. Speeding would not be a problem. They were also carrying Homeland Security creds that would check out all the way up the line, thanks to the late Jimmy Numbers. The little twins, P and Pod, were using the True's sophisticated satellite communications gear to monitor police chatter in the Northeast, and so far, there had been nothing about the possible kidnapping of a young girl. This was good news, but not unexpected. Friends smart enough to set up an ambush were probably smart enough to know what could happen to their chickadee if they went public. Another phone rang, this one muffled. Without taking his eyes off the road, Crow leaned across his sleeping passengers, reached into the glove compartment, and found a cell. The geezer's, no doubt. He held it up to his eyes. There was no name, so the caller wasn't in the phone's memory, but the number had a New Hampshire area code. One of the ambushers, wanting to know if Billy and the girl were all right? Very likely. Crow considered answering it and decided not to. He would check later to see if the caller had left a message, though. Information was power. When he leaned over again to return the cell to the glove compartment, his fingers touched metal. He stowed the phone and brought out an automatic pistol. A nice bonus, and a lucky find. If the geezer had awakened a little sooner than expected, he might have gotten to it before Crow could read his intentions. Crow slid the Glock under his seat, then flipped the glove compartment closed. Guns were also power. 11. It was full dark, and they were deep into the Green Mountains on Highway 108 when Abra began to stir. Crow, still feeling brilliantly alive and aware, wasn't sorry. For one thing, he was curious about her. For another, the old truck's gas gauge was touching empty and someone was going to have to fill the tank. But it wouldn't do to take chances. With his right hand, he removed one of the two remaining hypos from his pocket and held it on his thigh. He waited until the girl's eyes, still soft and muzzy, opened. Then he said, "Good evening, little lady. I'm Henry Rothman. Do you understand me?"
"You're..." Abra cleared her throat, wet her lips, tried again. "You're not Henry anything. You're the Crow."
"So you do understand. That's good. You feel woolly-headed just now, I imagine, and you're going to stay that way because that's just how I like you. But there will be no need to knock you all the way out again as long as you mind your P's and Q's. Have you got that?"
"Where are we going?"
"Hogwarts, to watch the International Quidditch tourney. I'll buy you a magic hot dog and a cone of magic cotton candy. Answer my question. Are you going to mind your P's and Q's?"
"Yes."
"Such instant agreement is pleasing to the ear, but you'll have to pardon me if I don't completely trust it. I need to give you some vital information before you try something foolish that you might regret. Do you see the needle I have?"